Now, we have been speaking about the indications that the hepatitis B vaccine was the vector in through which AIDS was introduced into the gay community in New York City. And Dr. Poitz did a study, as you mentioned, Lynn, which totally omitted the New York City experimental vaccine trials as a possible source. Therefore, it was obviously skewed. Now, it turns out that Dr. Poitz was very close professionally to Dr. Gallo.
Well, yes, indeed. They were all in a very small, intimate group of researchers that were connected to the National Cancer Institute and to the monkey virus cancer studies and the vaccine trials. And so it's, interestingly enough, when people say, well, how could this possibly be? I mean, you can't have a conspiracy of this size without people knowing about it. Well, interestingly enough, it's not a large number of people or organizations or institutions that are involved. It's a very, I would say, it's a handful of people.
And again, we want to note the institutions and their overlap with national security. The war on cancer, Richard Nixon's war on cancer, basically utilizes Fort Detrick under the auspices of Litton Bionetics. Merck Sharp & Dohme, top BW contractor. Maurice Hilleman, their top Hep B researcher involved with military research. The cell cultures for the war, for the special viral cancer research program, Litton Bionetics and NCI, maintained at the Naval Biosciences Laboratory by Gruber and Hilleman, both longtime veterans of the of Fort Detrick. Down at the Delta Primate Center, we've got Peter Girone, whom you also have written about. Lynn, another interesting detail, and by the way, after this, I want to move on to a discussion of HIV-2, the Big Bang Theory. I'd like to get Ed Haslam and Lynn Horowitz dialoguing on this. One of the things you point out, Alan, in AIDS and the Doctors of Death, is that this sort of cynical experimentation, because you theorize that this was done deliberately, or perhaps even murder, is not unprecedented in the history of American research. And specifically, you cite not only another sexually transmitted disease, but another experimental program conducted on people who are sort of out of the political mainstream and viewed with disfavor. Talking about the Tuskegee experiment.
Yeah, that took place in Tuskegee, Alabama, through the U.S. Public Health Service, which is now the CDC. And it took place over a 40-year period stemming from the 30s until the 1970s, where under political pressure from particularly the black leadership, the experiment was stopped. And it basically involved a group of several hundred black illiterate sharecroppers in Alabama who had a diagnosis of syphilis, and in order for physicians to study the progression of syphilis in these black men, the physicians lied to these black sharecroppers and told them only that they had bad blood and that they would take over their care free. And what these scientists decided to do then was to keep an eye on these men, and when they died, they were very eager to get an autopsy study to determine what the effects of untreated syphilis would be. Now, in the 1940s, when penicillin came in as a cure, as a very simple cure for syphilis, they decided not to tell these men to not treat them with penicillin, but to continue the non-treatment and the watchful waiting of this disease until these men died. And, of course, in the process, obviously, you know, the men could transmit this disease to their wives and to their lovers, and children of offsprings could be affected because, as you know, syphilis can be a congenital disease as well. And so this is one experiment that is very fresh to this day in the mind, particularly of the black community, which makes it perhaps understandable why, in a survey that the New York Times did back in the early 90s, a third of black people thought that AIDS was definitely a disease that came out of a laboratory to target blacks. A third of the blacks thought it was possible, and the other third said no. It's interesting because over the weekend we talked about this recent measles vaccine experiment that took place covertly in Los Angeles under the auspices of Kaiser Permanente and the CDC, where over 1,500 babies, they were mostly black and Latino, were given a vaccine, a very powerful vaccine, measles vaccine, which turned out to be an experimental vaccine, which had been previously used in Africa and had caused some problems, particularly premature deaths in the female babies. And finally, somebody blew the whistle on this, and of course, the CDC said, well, you know, it was a mistake, this vaccine fell through the cracks. And it turns out that this vaccine was notorious for causing immunosuppression in these babies, and the vaccine was given at the age of 9 months. And so for 6 months to 3 years after this vaccine was given, it was found that this could immunosuppress the babies. And the point is that these experiments still continue to this day, and particularly minorities, I think, are very subject to these experiments. I mean, no one ever expects to take your kid to Kaiser Permanente, but I've worked for Kaiser Permanente for 29 years and expect that their child would be part of some covert medical experiment. So when people are paranoid, as far as I'm concerned, they have a right to be, because people are still being damaged. I also think that it's not a coincidence that when gay men came out of the closet in large numbers in the 70s, that within a few years they would be combating a plague that is, you know, is still decimating the gay community.
Now, when information began to circulate that there were problems with the blood bank in New York City, and that perhaps something was indeed rotten in Denmark with regard to the blood, an individual surfaced as New York City Health Commissioner who had been involved with the Tuskegee study in CDC.
David Sensor, right, exactly. Well, he was a master at fending off the media's and the public's criticisms and scrutiny in Tuskegee, and so they sent him to the New York City to become the health department director in New York, and of course he was literally having to fend off the gay community's concerns regarding the tainted blood and the hepatitis B vaccine trial information, and this was a 1982, 83, 84, when the whole world was waking up to this new agent called AIDS. And that was the center of this controversy, the steps of New York City Blood Bank and the New York Public Health Department.
Point being that David Sensor had helped to fend off media criticism when with CDC. He helped to perpetuate the Tuskegee studies into the 1970s. He then moves to the position of New York City Health Commissioner and functions in a similar media/defensive role with regard to the New York City blood supply. We're going to move now in the direction of some of the research, curious aspects of the research that was conducted on minorities. One thing that I would like Ed Haslam and Leonard Horowitz to kick around, and that concerns the SV40 virus, the HIV-2 in Africa, the Big Bang Theory, or the jumping generations, as you put it, Ed, in an earlier interview, and perhaps also work in the work of Mary Sherman, the SE polyoma, and how this relates to all of these things. I realize that's a tall order, but I'm sure you're up to it.
Ed, you want to go first?
No.
All right, let me align the battle.
I have an interesting story to relay to you regarding that. I mean, the HIV-2, which is was found. Now, this is a fascinating story, and this will show you and show your listeners the absurdity of the arguments that these top experts in AIDS, Max Essex, Dr. Robert Gallo, and others, the absurdity of their arguments. Now, for those who do not know, HIV-2 was like the AIDS virus. It was discovered by Dr. Max Essex, and he was found this HIV-2, which he said was, quote, the missing link to the human AIDS virus, because there's apparently no tree. Ed, I think you make this point very, very clear. The Nicholsons make this point clear, that if you took the evolution and made an evolutionary tree of most viruses, they connect to a tree, and you see the branches and you see the limbs. Whereas with the AIDS virus, it's a limb standing off by itself, and so there's missing links.
The specific phrase I think you used, Ed, in Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus is you quoted, I believe it was Max Essex, in saying that the virus appears to have jumped generations.
Well, it's the sudden appearance of a virus without any ancestry.
Exactly.
Is one of the two main arguments for saying that it's created somehow. The other argument that I think really is the one that nails it is comes out of Los Alamos National Laboratories, where they did all this genetic analysis of it, and they measure from generation to generation the amount that it doesn't make a perfect copy of itself. In other words, that variation, which they call the intrinsic error frequency rate. Now, they have measured this for all kind of viruses, and they put it up on a graph, and you have an envelope. You have high error frequency rate, and you have low error frequency rate. And everything that they have found has fallen in this graph. Now, along comes HIV-1. They measure the intrinsic error frequency rate, and it's outside the envelope. That leaves you one of two choices. You may redefine nature in order to include HIV-1, or you have to call it unnatural, period. I mean, those are the only two logical choices you got.
Yeah. HIV-2 is another interesting virus.
Yeah, so that's the story that I'd like to relay, the HIV-2 story. Now, this story will tell you and show you the lack of common sense and the absolute bogusness of these arguments and this connection to contaminated vaccines. So Max Essex finds HIV-2. Where does he find this missing link to the human AIDS virus, the one that's closest to the human AIDS virus? He finds it in Senegalese women, prostitutes. That's in Western Africa, in Senegal. He finds this virus and he declares this is the closest thing to the human AIDS virus. Well, a few months later, researchers get this virus and they, including Dr. Robert Gallo, declare that no, Max Essex is wrong. This virus is a monkey virus and a laboratory contaminant. That HIV-2 is virtually identical to the simian immunodeficiency virus from the macaque monkey. Now, the question becomes, how does a monkey virus that does not exist in macaques in the wild, because they researched these monkeys in the wild, they found that it doesn't exist in the monkeys in the wild, it only exists in the laboratory monkeys. So it's a monkey virus contaminant. So the question is, how does a monkey virus that does not exist in monkeys in the wild end up in Senegalese women other than through vaccine contaminants? And that's exactly what I asked Max Essex in front of six other reporters from San Francisco about in March when I was here at the National AIDS Update meeting. And he hemmed and he hawed and he beat around the bush. And finally, when I pressed him, he says, well, I can tell you how it got into my monkeys. And he says, how it got into my monkeys was that the monkey providers, the monkey traders, had shipped these contaminated monkeys to me after they had been previously used by other researchers who had inoculated them with human tissue during various other disease experiments, which is an indication of how contaminated these monkeys are. This was already in the late 80s, early 90s when this is going on. This is still going on today. It's an indication of how poor the biohazard and containment still is to this very day in these maximum security laboratories, allegedly. And on top of that, it's a clear indication that he skirted the issue, wouldn't answer the issue. The bottom line is the only plausible explanation of how it got to these women. Now think, these women are prostitutes. In Senegal, it is legal, it is very well known that this prostitution goes on, and what they do is they vaccinate these women for sexually transmitted diseases, specifically the hepatitis B vaccine again. So everything points to the hepatitis B vaccine and or contaminated vaccines, but the basic researchers, they seem to lose their common sense when presented with the facts.
Alan, quickly, because I want to also get in before we take a break and do some more fundraising and bring in Garth Nicholson. I want to talk about the SV40 and the polyoma, but you had a comment.
Well, I just wanted to say to people, they all recall the controversy between Montigny, who discovered the virus, and I think people are well aware that Gallo said, this is my virus, and Montigny said, no, it's mine, and he said, yours is a different virus. Well, then it turned out to be exactly the same virus. So it makes you think, well, if a person cannot tell when two things are exactly the same, why does one consider his theories as to be credible as far as the origin? And also, when the Pasteur Institute decided to sue the American government, one of the reasons that they settled this thing was that the French lawyers knew that Gallo had made previous serious errors in virus identification. For example, in 1975, he discovered, and that's in quotes, a new and a human HL23 virus that eventually proved to be three contaminating ape viruses. And the names of those ape viruses are gibbon ape virus, simian sarcoma virus, and baboon endogenous virus. And Gallo to this day claims he still has no idea how these viruses contaminated his research, which means that he was not able to tell a human virus from an animal virus and a new virus from a contaminant virus. So one really has to question the credibility and the authenticity of these declarations as to who is the mother and father of anything in a virus.
And with regard to the Montagnier-Gallo controversy, also we should remember, and this is something you discussed in your book, Len, and something that Dr. Robert Strecker talks about, is that these individuals were very closely associated, exchanging research, working together, and that, interestingly enough, the IPP, the Institut Pasteur Production, was deeply involved with French biological warfare research. So again, this overlapping of institutions. Now, something that both Len and Ed spoke about at considerable length in their books, and in a sense it's the one of the titular elements in your book, Ed, is the SV40 monkey virus. And if you could talk about that virus, and it's both of you could talk about that virus, the SE polyoma, and the work that you've both done on those viruses.
Okay. During our conversation here, we've used the term cancer virus a lot, and I know that in terms of the general population, a lot of people don't have any clue that viruses have anything to do with cancer. And for example, if you pick up the facts and figures on cancer published by the American Cancer Society, they don't even mention viruses involved in this. What's very interesting, if you go back into the history of virus research on cancer, and it goes back to the beginning of the century. In fact, the Pasteur Institute published a book in 1901 on parasitic theories of cancer, but it really, the intellectual trail starts with Peyton Rouse and the Rouse sarcoma thing in 1911. But by the time you get to the 1950s, there's some pretty serious researchers at the National Institute of Health who are closing in on this whole subject of cancer-causing viruses. And in 1957, two women researchers, they're both MD, PhDs, one is named Sarah Stewart and the other is called Bernice Eddy, they isolate and identify a virus which they name polyoma, meaning that it causes many types of cancers. Because it causes many types of cancers, but not only in one animal, in multiple mammals, mostly small rodents, etc. And this event in 1957 really blows open the doors of congressional funding at NIH for research in cancer-causing viruses. It is really one of the major events. If you look at Time magazine, 1959, July 27, 1959, the cover article on Time magazine talks about the new war on cancer through virus research and chemotherapy. Okay, so this was front page news, Time magazine.
What year was this, Ed?
1959.
Okay.
Okay, the major researchers at the National Institute of Health, and now you can't even... And plus, and the stuff that Len brought out so beautifully in his book was this two-decade-long, multi-billion-dollar research project financed by the United States government on the special viral cancer programs. I mean, it's there in spades, and in the moment you turn to mass media and mass culture, nobody wants to talk about it.
Bearing in mind two points also. First of all, the point that Alan Cantwell started this train of discussion with way back when, saying that in his book, he posited the origin of AIDS, the genesis of AIDS, with cancer research. Hold that in mind. Also, remember what we've already talked about, this for the benefit of the audience, what we've talked about already with the special viral cancer research program. It's overlap with Fort Detrick, Litton Bionetics, people like Hellman and Gruber, and the overlaps with Gallo and the research we've already spoken about. Now, again, Ed, with regard to cancer research, or cancer viruses, rather, with regard to the SE polyoma and the poliovirus and the contamination of that, you discuss Richard Nixon's apparent role in helping to deal with the Qatar fiasco in connection with this.
Well, what the Qatar fiasco was the first wave of polio vaccines that was widely distributed was the Salk vaccine, and I forget the exact year, but it's about 1955 or so. And what happens is, again, it is given to Bernice Eddy, who's the head of the safety lab at the National Institute of Health, and she flunks it. She gives it to her monkeys, and they fall over crippled and dead, and she takes photographs of them, and she goes and hands the photographs to the management of the National Institute of Health, and they turn around and decide to release the vaccine anyway. Okay? And when they release the vaccine, what happens is children start dying and getting polio from the vaccine, just as Bernice Eddy had predicted. And this was identified as a batch of the Salk vaccine, which came from the Qatar laboratories, which is why this whole incident is called the Qatar incident. Now, knowing that the management of the National Institute of Health had been warned about this in advance by the person whose job it was to warn them. I mean, not a journalist from the outside or something, but the person who was in charge of their safety lab. They were in an indefensible position, and the entire management of the National Institute of Health got fired. And the political flack that came along with this was the biggest fiasco in medical history, okay? And it didn't stop with just the management of the National Institute of Health, which was a division of the U.S. Public Health Service, which was a division of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. The buck stopped with the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, who was Ovetta Hobby, and Ovetta Hobby got fired, okay? Now, in order to fire a cabinet member in the United States government, there's really only two people that can do it. I mean, it's got to be the president or the vice president. So who are the president and vice president? The president was Dwight Eisenhower, and the vice president was Richard Nixon. Now, Dwight Eisenhower, first of all, he was sick throughout much of his presidency, but he was also very involved with the Cold War and the international situation, and left many of these jobs, particularly the nasty jobs of firing cabinet members, to his vice president. So Nixon is the one who had to fire Ovetta Hobby, and Nixon, with that, had to rebuild this whole project. He had to get another HEW secretary on board and moving. He had to get the polio program back up on its feet. They stopped with the Salk vaccine, and they started with Albert Sabin's vaccine, which used a not a neutralized or dead virus vaccine like Salk had tried to do, neutralizing the polio virus with formaldehyde. But he said you just use a live vaccine, but use a weak strain of polio. So they switched strategies at that point. Now what happens is this, is if you remember my previous conversation about Bernice Eddy and Sarah Stewart discovering polyoma, once the Sabin vaccine gets distributed, I mean millions and millions and millions of doses all over the place, and Eddy and Stewart discover polyoma and the congressional funding comes in, well, the guys with the electron microscope start cataloging all these simian viruses that they're finding in the monkeys, and they find one, the 40th one they found. They found hundreds of them, but the 40th one they found, which they called SV, simian virus number 40, turned out to be virtually identical to polyoma. And when Bernice Eddy learned about this, she said, she asked herself just a really frightening question. She said, well, if that's the case, then we grew these, this polio vaccine on these monkey kidney cells, and is there a possibility that this cancer-causing monkey virus, which is identical to polyoma, is alive in those monkey cells? And she went back and secretly did some research and found that, yes, they were. The SV40 and a whole bunch of other stuff, as Len alluded to earlier, was alive in the monkey kidney tissue upon which they grew the polio vaccine. And that is when she raised the question, have we just mass inoculated the American public with a cancer-causing virus?
And you theorize, of course, in your book that Mary Sherman may very well have been working in this secret laboratory with a linear accelerator to mutate viruses in connection with research into this contamination.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that are really clear about this. This discovery and announcement and the political flack that goes on with it occurs right before the 1960 presidential election. This is, I mean, people just don't forgive politicians for giving the killing their children. I mean, this is stuff that can change who runs the country. And right at that time is also when Sarah Stewart, who's already a legend in the NIH, she all of a sudden transfers over to the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. Now, I mean, to the U.S. Public Health Service. Now, Sarah Stewart is like Mary Sherman's best friend. They went to the University of Chicago Medical School together. They both entered as freshmen in the same year. They were, you know, women medical students in the 1930s who maintained their contact throughout the career because they were both cancer researchers. And I think the issue that comes up is this treatise that's found, this document that's found in David Ferry's apartment, to my eyes, is written by Sarah Stewart. And I think the argument for that is pretty good. And how would David Ferry come about an unpublished document that was an internal document at NIH written by their leading cancer researcher other than getting it through a intermediate contact such as Mary Sherman?
Now, Richard Nixon, you theorize, was one of the individuals, or basically, Richard Nixon helps to give people their walking papers with regard to the Cutter fiasco, and then it is under Richard Nixon's war on cancer that a lot of the research that Len is talking about with a special viral cancer research program for Dietrich Litton, et cetera, is conducted.
Right. And, you know, I just want to add to what Ed has just talked about with regard to SV40 again. Now, it was interesting that although the women, these incredibly brilliant women, discovered this SE polyoma virus, it was Hilleman that actually claimed credit for the discovery of this SV40, which, as Ed said, was exactly identical. Now, I want to share a couple things with your listeners that are extremely important. The number one thing is that SV40 launched a complete revolution in the use of viruses to deliver RNA and DNA and other cancer genes and genes in general to cells and to affect different animals and human beings. And when we hear today over and over and over again the marvelous biotechnology revolution, which is now bringing gene therapy to the world, which we're going to be able to affect absolutely everything from the color of your teeth to your predisposition to cancer. All of this people do not understand is based on the concept of taking a virus to use that as an envelope to mail into your cells specific genes that it really change and alter completely the way nature has designed, God has designed your natural genes. And the fact of the matter is these are viruses, these are contaminants, these are literally capable of recombining with other, either what they call endogenous, that's natural virus genes or natural genes in the body, or foreign genes, animal genes or human, foreign viruses or natural genes that the humans contain. So that's something that people should understand. The next thing is that these vaccines, the contamination of vaccines that Ed has so brilliantly discussed in his book, and Alan has talked about with regard to hepatitis B. The fact of the matter is that today, the major problem is that today's oral polio vaccine that we're required by law to give our children are still littered with simian monkey virus contaminants, to the tune as much as 100 simian virus contaminants per dose of the oral polio vaccine is today required. The FDA is really required to turn a blind eye to that level of contamination. In fact, it is the pharmaceutical industries that literally muzzle the FDA through proprietary laws and non-disclosure laws, so that the FDA can't even tell health scientists truly what the levels of contamination in these vaccines are and what the risk to human beings are of getting these vaccines. Now, the co-author of my book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, Dr. W. John Martin, makes a point very, very clear that it is this problem that is perhaps the most critical issue affecting United States public, actually world health today, because what we're seeing in terms of the new epidemics from chronic fatigue syndrome to perhaps Gulf War syndrome that you're going to now be getting to interview Dr. Nicholson.
We're going to be bringing him in a minute.
Great. Perfect timing.
I had one question, though, but finish up the point you're making. I had one more topic
sure.
I wanted to briefly touch on, and then we're going to take a break.
Sure.
I'm going to twist the listeners' arms, and we're going to bring in Dr. Nicholson.
Okay. And so it's chronic fatigue, it's AIDS, it's attention deficit disorders, it's hyperactivity disorders in children, it's the Guillain-Barre's, it's the autoimmune diseases all of a sudden, it's the, like Ed's talking about, it's prostate, it's perhaps prostate, perhaps liver cancers, perhaps all of these different, these new epidemics that are skyrocketing today came from nowhere, but all of a sudden announced themselves in the 1980s, which can be directly related to vaccine contamination. That is why your listeners are urged to read these books, because it's not just gays, it's not just blacks, it's every single human being on the face of this planet that's at risk.
One of the major points that you bring up in your book, Lennon, that we only have a very short period of time to touch on this, but many of the diseases that appear to lie in the background or foreground of the development, deliberate or accidental, the man-made development of these diseases, deliberate and or accidental, we're talking about hepatitis B. We're talking about various types of cancers. We're talking about mononucleosis, leukemia. These are diseases that occur all over the world. And one of the things you point out in your book, though, Len, is that the focal point for the researchers who loom in the foreground of the information we've been discussing, they all were focusing on Africa.
Yes, indeed. It's unfortunate that the African people have been specifically targeted for decades now, perhaps even centuries, as being the guinea pigs, if you will, for experiments involving pharmaceuticals or different other trials. And it was particularly in Central Africa and Northwest Uganda where we literally, in the book, publish a map showing you that where these specific incidents and these experiments involving hepatitis and breast cancer tumor viruses, that they were experimenting with animals, they were testing them very clearly in, I believe, human subjects as well. And it was Litton Bionetics, by the way, that maintained that contract that was doing these experiments.
And that apparently, according to your research, had a virtual monopoly on all of the monkeys being used by all of these research facilities on all of these diseases around the entire world.
Right, exactly. And I know we don't have a lot of time because I want to get to Garth Nicholson also, but I also traced the Ebola virus to Northwest Ugandan studies by John Landon at Litton Bionetics, where he literally took the mother of Marburg, which was the mother of Ebola, and he inoculated monkeys with them. 9 of them died. 9 were transferred to the vaccine production facilities wherein this epidemic initially surfaced in 1967.
Now, granted, what we're trying to do here on this broadcast is like trying to drink from a fire hose. There's an awful lot of information coming down the tube, and we're trying to assimilate as much as we can. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we're going to update some of these events right up to Persian Gulf War Syndrome. And it's my pleasure to introduce a fourth guest this evening. This is Dr. Garth Nicholson, who along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has done some very important and fascinating research concerning a possible biological warfare component to the Persian Gulf War syndrome. Dr. Nicholson, welcome to our program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on.
Dr. Nicholson, along with your wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, you have been doing research into some of the causes of Persian Gulf War syndrome, something that's very much in the news these days. And in some of the papers you've written, you've attributed that syndrome to a number of different causes, including a organism called a mycoplasma. Could you tell us a little bit about what a mycoplasma is and what makes this particular mycoplasma special and how you came across it?
Well, it's a very simple microorganism, very similar to a bacteria. It's not very complex in terms of the biologic systems that we normally deal with, but it's more complex than a virus. So it has genetic information in it, and what we found is that in about one half of the Gulf War illness patients that we've looked at, there's a very unusual type of microorganism, a mycoplasma, found deep inside their white blood cells. And this unusual form of mycoplasma has an inserted gene in it from the HIV-1 virus, the AIDS-causing virus. And it's very interesting because the gene that we found in it is exactly the type of gene that you'd put in this if you wanted to make a biologic weapon. Because this is the gene that encodes an envelope glycoprotein called GP120, and this is the component that's a receptor that allows this microorganism, we think, to attach to cells and enter cells just like the AIDS virus enters your cells.
Now, Dr. Horowitz has written about the mechanism by which the virus enters the cells as well. Could you tell us a little bit about how this, in words, explain for the layperson how the HIV or this apparently genetically engineered mycoplasma enters the cells?
Well, we think it uses a variety of receptors, mainly a receptor complex called the CD4 receptor complex. And it attaches to this and then is taken in what's known as an endocytotic vesicle inside the cell. And then it gets loose from that, and it then the genetic information gets into the cell and goes into the nucleus, essentially, eventually. And that's basically how it enters. It's much more complex than that, but I think for your listening audience, that will suffice.
So in other words, this mechanism, which is on this mycoplasma, actually enables the organism to enter into a cell's wall.
Well, that's what we think. We think it allows it to penetrate inside the cell, and that's what makes this particular microorganism so insidious, because once it's in the cell, it can use its metabolism more or less to poison the cell, and this causes a tremendous amount of problems. And also, when it divides inside the cell and is released eventually from the cell, it can take a little piece of membrane with it, and this sets up kind of an immune response against self. So it actually can trigger an autoimmune response, and we often see in these Gulf War illness patients very unusual autoimmune symptoms, very similar to MS, ALS, Graves' disease, for example, lupus, but they don't have these rare genetic diseases. In fact, we see some symptoms, combination of different diseases in the same patient. And all of these seem to go away when we treat with the appropriate antibiotics. So we don't think that these soldiers really had these unusual genetic diseases. We think that the mycoplasma may have caused these signs and symptoms which mimic these genetic diseases.
In an historical element, how did you first come across this organism?
Well, we got involved in this because our stepdaughter was served in Operation Desert Storm. She was a crew chief on a Black Hawk helicopter involved in the deep insertions into Iraq. And when she came back, she slowly came down with a chronic illness that we couldn't explain. It was very unusual, and there were so many different signs and symptoms. There were 30 or 40 different signs and symptoms, and then we slowly started to get it. And we noticed when we called around to several of her colleagues and so on that not only did they have the disease, but also their family members were starting to come down with it. So we knew that we weren't dealing with a chemical weapon. We were probably dealing with a biologic weapon that she'd picked up in Operation Desert Storm. Now, we traced this down just by going through these complex signs and symptoms, going back through the medical literature, trying to figure out what it might be. And we ruled out a lot of different diseases which are more acute in nature, tried to find down, settle on some of the chronic illnesses and what they might be caused by. And then we finally settled on mycoplasmas as a possibility, and sure enough, when we did the genetic testing, that's exactly what we found.
In your opinion, how did these troops become infected with this, or are you in a position to say?
Well, we've actually, in our testimony to the U.S. Congress, we've stated that there are four possible ways in which they were exposed. The first is that some of them may have gotten contaminated vaccines, and mycoplasmal contamination of vaccines is not uncommon because often they're made in animals, and animals are just as susceptible to humans in picking up these mycoplasmal infections. The second is that there were certain areas in the desert which we call exclusionary zones, in which the Iraqis may have actually placed chemical and biologic weapons, both by spraying them and by releasing them. And the military intelligence units that were deep in Iraq ran across some of these areas. They found that everything human and animal was dead in these areas. And so that's the second way. And the third is a more popular notion now, although when we presented it, it really was not, did not receive any press at all. And that's the blowback from destroyed bunkers and factories which contain chemical and biologic weapons. And as you know, the press has picked up on this recently, and now they've indicated that it's very likely that at least 15,000 soldiers were exposed to nerve agents and other chemical agents when they blew up these bunkers. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, they blew up hundreds of these bunkers and also a variety of different factories as well that had the biologic agents and chemical agents. And these could have been blown back across our lines because the prevailing winds during the time of the conflict were from northeast to southwest. So this would have carried all these agents back across our lines. And they would have been diluted, so they're probably in low level, and that would have explained why there weren't a large number of immediate signs and symptoms on the battlefield. It took some time after they returned home. And then finally, the Scud missiles that rained down on Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, Western Kuwait, for example, these often were manned, or they were tipped with skyburst warheads. So instead of using a high explosive warhead, some of the warheads were low yield warheads that blew up at 2,000 to 5,000 feet in the air, and they had dispersing capabilities. So they dispersed kind of a mist all over the battlefield, and this was described by a number of units, particularly reserve units behind the lines. And those units that were under Scud attack, they have very high casualties now. So there's not a uniform degree of casualties among the various units. It was very deployment dependent. And some of the units that were hardest hit were way behind the lines that were under Scud attack. So we think that may have played a very important role as well.